There's 7 o'clock, and Robert said, I have to start, so we'll go ahead and dig in here. Thanks for being here tonight. We're starting our second class in the book of Judges. So far, we're loosely aligned with the chapters. Tonight, we're kind of beginning in chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. Well, there we are. You are here. We're in the second week, and you might remember our class thesis is this idea that, and I think really chapter 2 lays out the class thesis exceedingly well, that repeatedly men, the nation of Israel, messes things up, finds themselves in a place of crisis, and just as repeatedly there is a God, a Savior, a Redeemer, who comes in and makes that salvation over and over. As many times as man messes up in this book, and as deep as they mess up, there is a loving God who comes in and restores them. And so as we work through the book, we're going to kind of capitalize on particular shortcomings, sins, issues that the people of Israel encountered in the story, and what crisis that led them to, and how God chose to come again and redeem them, and what a gracious and wonderful thing that is. So, next week, HE will be teaching, and then we'll go back and forth from there. We talked about some cultural aspects last week. We didn't really talk about the timeline of the Bible, and I always like to think through this with any study, mostly because it just kind of helps put things in perspective of what's going on, and maybe you're an old Bible scholar, and this is just inherently obvious to you, but I think it's good framing to recognize where we are, and there's nothing on here that I'm academic or willing to debate you over, but these are some loose interpretations of generally speaking, when some of these things happened. And, again, was it 446? Was it 1446 or 1440? That's not the point of this slide here. But you can see Abraham was probably born at about 2100 BC. And here we are, Israel was in Egypt for 400 years in that period. And here we are about 700 years later. The Exodus happens. What do we know happened between the Exodus and the Judges? At least 40 years of wandering, and then some time for the period of Joshua and the conquest to happen. So you could debate me that it was 1350 to 1050 BC. Not really here to put that in perspective, but really what this slide shows more than anything is the nation itself is in infancy. There's been a people, there's been a promise, there's been, many elements in the making, but the nation itself is in an infant stage. We haven't had the Psalms. We haven't had Proverbs of Solomon, right? We haven't had all these the books of literature that might show or reveal a little bit more about who God is. And, so we have to, that begs a very particular question. Anybody know what that question is that it begs? Did they have enough information? Is this just, an advent that they didn't know God, and so they were getting to know their creator, their promise maker, their savior? Is that the case here? And, I think we could point to a couple of things. Back when Moses was giving the law on the other side of Mount Sinai, he gave a very particular commandment in Deuteronomy, which was what?
Obey.
Enter the land, obey. But very specifically, he wanted them to teach their children. And in what way? We can go read it, Deuteronomy 6 and 7. Put it on the doorpost, yep. Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 7. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit down in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. Did they have anything to know? Well, I mean, if they were going to teach all this, if they were going to live it day in and day out, of course they had to have something to know.
They had their priesthood as well.
They had priesthood had been established. And then they had seen many things. Now, you could argue maybe half of these things only Joshua and Caleb had seen, but certainly the elders started to see some of these things as children, you know, maybe wandering in the wilderness or definitely during the conquest. But look at this list here. On the left side, you see the 10 plagues, the Passover, the Red Sea, manna, you know, just surviving, being saved. They'd seen wonderful things that God had done. And most recently, the destruction of the walls of Jericho, which they had to have known. They didn't move a stone, right? Like, God can do it. God will do it for this promised people. And on the other side of that, when you depart from God, what happens? You know, the swallowing up of rebellious people into the ground, or the wandering of wilderness for 40 years because you didn't have enough faith to believe in God.
They also had their feasts and their festivals. Absolutely.
Yeah, they had certain remembrances and even some monuments set up already, right? So that they could remember. Yeah, Mike.
God is not going to expect us to do anything that we don't know what to do, no matter whether it was then or now. You know, he's not going to expect them to teach their children if he hasn't taught them. Not saying it's everything, but he's not going to make that requirement if they don't know what to do with it.
It'd be quite a foolish errand to send them on if they had no ammunition to use, right? Yeah. Yeah. So we see here in Judges 2:7 what? The people who saw these things fulfilled their duty. They served the Lord. Joshua was successful in his efforts to have the conquest that he pursued. And as long as Joshua and the elders of that day were alive, the people followed God. So there's something to be said here, right? About those who had seen all these great works. What do you think about that? That they followed the people who saw these great works followed God all of the days.
They didn't teach.
They didn't. Clearly, they did not do something here, right? That's one thing.
Plus, they didn't drive out the inhabitants, so they got corrupted and began to worship Baal.
Certainly, the unfulfillment of their duty here had a long-term effect. But is there something to be said for them serving the Lord and what they'd experienced? About their faith? Yeah, Xavier.
I think these people are the kids of the people that were in the desert for so long. And they saw their parents have faithlessness. And I think that especially what that acted out for them, they saw, like, all right, we got nothing better but to trust God, and they did. And then, my goodness, what happened is, like, half of the book of Joshua is just all the lands that were given to them, and so I think that, yeah, they experienced very a lot of hardship through their parents and because of their parents in the desert. And they realized through that, and part of probably God's plan was for them to realize this, that, like, we got no better bet than to bet on God.
Yep. I think what I hear you say is because they experienced God, they had faith in God. experience God as part of their day-to-day life. Yeah.
Nick. Well, also goes to show that while the people had the experience in God and they had the history of God, the importance of leadership. Because as an organic unit, Israel did not follow God. Israel was led by the leaders to follow God. And they, for the most part, followed up until Joshua's death. After that, in verse 10, speaks that there came a generation that knew not God.
So. Yeah. So going back to last week, we talked about partial obedience, or as Xavier said, you might as well just call it disobedience, right? There was this compromise, right? They didn't drive out the people of the land, and the consequence for that was God said, fine, I won't drive them out from among you permanently. That if you're not going to do what I say, I can't fulfill my promise to you. You have not come to redeem the promise that I have made to you, and therefore you will suffer this thorn throughout the life of the nation here. And, you know, that's what the angel at Bethlehem comes, the angel to the weepers to say, you've not been convicted. Convict yourselves now and serve God and do what he says to do. So they made this compromise. And then I think the logical conclusion is they did not teach their children. If they had done the commandment of 6, 6, and 7, what do you think would have happened? Not this whole rest of this book, right? If they had done, I think the inevitable conclusion that you make from Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 7 is if they had done what God had said here, they would have stayed true to him and the promise. Yeah, Rick.
They must have been disobedient because anyone found worshiping another god was to be stoned. And so there was obviously a lot of people that weren't dying as a result of this idolatry that they were taking on as they were fading away. So it was multiple aspects of things that, you know, they should have been doing, teaching, executing judgment on those that weren't being faithful, dot, dot, dot. But they got to a point where they were just wandering away.
I think there, and what I hope to explore a little bit more with you is, this next generation didn't experience God. It didn't have the faith, so they didn't drive out the people, and therefore they were among them. And you know, this causality was kind of a snowball effect from here. Yeah, Lee.
Perhaps a different thought than we might have ever thought before. Just, they're depending on a bunch of 20-year-olds because no one over 20 was allowed to go into the land. And so all of the decisions are being made once those people who had witnessed the plagues and the Passover and the Red Sea, you're relying on 20-year-olds to be the guidance and to actually follow God's word, even if they were taught as children, as their parents are dying in the wilderness, you're still depending on a bunch of 20-year-olds or younger to lead you to follow God.
Go back and look at that closer, but they did better than their parents. How about that? Did you have a comment, Ian?
Only if there's time. I just am drawing this parallel. Reading this passage is making me think of a spiritual parallel and how I'm, you know, what do I take away from their disobedience today? And if you think about, you know, driving the people out of the land and breaking down all of their altars, if you think about that in the context of sin, like, what is the sin that God has made this covenant with us in the same way that he did with Israel? It's a new covenant, right? But he's made this promise to us of what we can have through him, salvation. But we have all these altars, these things that we previously worshiped or maybe struggle, and we still worship, we put before God. Have we stricken them out of our lives? And if we don't do that completely, and get rid of it completely, it's always a thorn in our side. It's always something that will hurt us and help and pull us away from God.
That was our very rushed conclusion last week, right? If we're called to crucify ourselves, you can't do that partially. There's no partial putting to death of one's old ways, right? And that has to be fully convicted and fully pursued. And in essence, not to be like the children of Israel here. So, you know, Judges, I said this last week, Judges 2 tells us the cycle of sin in a very, we have these different ways of trying to remember it, but it tells us what this cycle of sin is explicitly, and that's what the rest of chapter 2 is really doing, is highlighting this cycle for us. And, we know this from several alliterations, but they sin, they drift away from God. I don't think the last elder died and they just woke up the next day and said, all hail Baal, let's go do the opposite of what God says, right? I don't think that's what we see here in the text. They drift from God. They fall into idolatry. God allows for them to be oppressed in some way, servitude, defeat. They're remorseful. They cry out for redemption. God raises them a deliverer. There's peace. And then they quickly return to their old ways. That's the rest of chapter 2. We haven't even gotten to the fact of a hero yet, right? We're 2 chapters in, and we haven't even discussed the hero, and we're already tired of this cycle of sin. What do you think the author is saying? And you could make the author God in this case directly if you want to. Like, I grew tired of these people not following me. And yet, over and over, I redeemed them. Over and over, I brought salvation. Over and over, I had a heart of compassion. And that is the entire second chapter here. We'll go through that.
You say that they didn't suddenly wake up one day and go, I'm going to follow Baal. It was a gradual process. Nothing's different from today.
Of the church drift away. It's not a, okay, I'm done with it, I'm going to go back to the world. It's just a cumulative effect over and over, and then suddenly they wake up one day and went, wow, I am a member of the world again and not a member of God's people.
If they wake up at all.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yes, Lee.
I want to reconsider my thoughts from earlier. Because if they were 20 when they said they were going to wander for 40 years, they might have been 60 when it was all said and done, and my math was faulty. So,
well, whatever their age, they came in and seemed to do at least serve the Lord. Maybe they didn't teach their children, but to their credit, they did serve the Lord. But nonetheless, we'll go do math later. To Mike's point, I mean, this whole book, this chapter is about the repetitive nature of human failure and that drifting and the persistent nature of God having grace and returning the people to them. And so we see in the first, few verses here, 6 through 10, Joshua's death comes about. And I kind of jumped the gun on this slide, but all the people who serve the Lord, they had seen what God had done. They experienced God. And I think there's something to be said for living a life that experiences God and not just maybe hearing about it. Hearing about it tends to lead towards the mythology effect or the, oh, that was the way you believed. Oh, that's what you saw. You know, if you just hear about God and never experience Him, and, are you really going to have that relationship where you can have faith to go conquer the land, that you can have faith to stand up to peers, to the world around you when they're worshiping idols? The point I'd like to make, though, is they had all the information. It wasn't about a lack of information. It wasn't about a lack of understanding who God was, and it certainly wasn't an lack of understanding of what God could and would do in certain situations. So is experiential exposure to God necessary to have faith in Him? It's a big question, I think. Is experiential exposure to God necessary to have faith in Him? Clearly not. Oh, nobody's saying yes?
It depends on how you define that, right? I mean, you can experience God in many different ways. you can experience God, his truth and his love through a Christian in the way that they treat you, right? You can come here and you can experience God. So I think in a way, yes, you do. You have to see God through someone else or through an experience with someone else or with him in some way, whether it's by communion here as a community of brothers and sisters in Christ, and you just so happen to be there for the first time and you get to experience something that is outside the realm of the physical that you've never experienced before. I think that might spark a desire, a curiosity that only God understand. You know, only God really truly knows how that works, right? I'm just speaking from my own experience. There's something that pulls you, that draws you, and I think you can't have that experience without being in the presence of God.
Well, Jesus told Thomas, because you've seen me and believed, you see, that's why he believed, because he saw Jesus resurrected. But blessed are those that have not seen and have believed. So obviously he's expecting people in future generations to believe on him through the word that has been revealed and through the continued teaching. And at the same time, there were many that saw Jesus and saw the miracles and yet rejected him. So that's not a fully necessary thing, that just because you've seen it, you're going to believe and be faithful, that you have to have the right kind of faith, whether you see him or whether you learn from him by his word.
Yeah, I didn't hear all that Rick said, but he said a number of things that I was going to add here. But the bottom line is, we live by faith. The righteous man shall walk by faith. In the passage that Rick quoted, that blessed are those who believe without seeing. Therefore, we are a matter of not being able to see the spiritual realm with our physical eyes. We trust in God's word and obey him by faith, for faithfulness in our faith. However, I will say this, and I don't want to get too hocus pocus, but after living nearly 80 years, I've got the advantage, if you will, of being able to look back upon my life. And I see some things that are inexplicable. I see answered prayer. I mean, specific things that I prayed for that came to pass quickly. I've seen difficult times that I was delivered out of that I can't explain. And I won't go into those particular details, but I think you need to be alert for God's providential care. He's there. Does he answer prayer? He does. A lot of times he doesn't. And then you pray the yielding prayer that Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane and remain faithful. The other times he does. And you just need to be alert, be aware of it, and give thanks for those times when you've been delivered.
So I think to Rick's point and to Brian's point, there are certain events where you see the walls of Jericho come down. That does not mean you're going to have faith in and of itself. And there are people who are not going to see Jesus or the walls fall down. And yet they are still going to have, maybe to Ian's point, experience God in other fashion. And if you were just teaching your children, but you weren't living it, how are they going to experience? If you were just teaching your neighbor, but not living it, going back to this command in Deuteronomy 6, it's when you walk, it's when you sleep, it's when you get, it's all the time. Are you living a life that gives other people this exposure to experience God? And I think we have a big part to play in that as well. But just hearing the stories, I don't think is going to give you faith. Yeah, Tom.
I believe that many of their people did not have a clue that they were a chosen people with a mission. And where there's no vision personally, the people perish. They did not see that they were a chosen people with a mission from.
Yeah, if the parents failed to do what Deuteronomy 6 said, how could the people know what their mission was? And one last comment here, Xavier, and
Thank you. But what Ian is saying is that you experience God through the body of Christ more often than you experience him directly. And kind of like Rick was saying, that's necessary but not sufficient to have faith in God. Everyone, if they've had any interaction with either the Spirit of God, or the Spirit of God lives in all of us. It's not, we've all experienced God through each other, but that's not clearly sufficient to believe in God. There's a choice we have to make. And yeah.
Good comments here. Now, I think what my draw on here is that knowledge alone is not enough, right? Just having the stories in your head is not enough to build the faith that moves you to conviction. And I really appreciate the conversation there. It's certainly applicable to us today. So then we move into this idea of the drip, what I'm calling the drift here, and that is our major failure or weakness of the people in this moment. And it's been said several times already, but Judges 2:10, Joshua dies, the elders die, and the next verse says, there arose another generation who did not know the Lord or the work he had done for Israel. The parents, they didn't know. Not only did they not experience, their parents failed them here, right? No one was adhering to Deuteronomy 6. And again, I don't see this. It's a next generation, right? This isn't like the elders died and the next day they all got up and said, okay, we're done with that. This had to happen over what, 20, 30 years? Maybe 18, I don't know. But, a significant amount of time. It's not 13 days later. And you have a straight line, you're walking the straight and narrow, and you turn by a degree, and it doesn't seem that much for a long, long, 1 degree doesn't seem like that much for a long, but you do that, I don't know what your pace is or your gait, but you do that over 18 years, 20, 30 years, and all of a sudden, you're way off, right? You are nowhere near, you might not even be able to see the straight and narrow anymore. And, what does it first say? They worship Baal because their neighbors were about agriculture, right? The crops didn't come in. Something happened in their life, and they were looking for a supplement. They were looking for a little bit more to God. It wasn't complete expulsion of the Jehovah of Abraham. It wasn't this idea that we're just going to throw out everything we've ever known. But what does God call it? Man, you can't read that. This is a good slide. Compromise. They didn't run out the people of the land. Drift. They slowly didn't teach their children and simultaneously assimilated. And so they worshiped idols. And what does God call that? Sin. Abandonment of God. There is a way to tell this story that seems just incremental and easy and not that big of a deal yet. To the point of any deviation is sin, is abandonment, and is abandonment of God here, right? And we see that specifically in verse 13. I think it's worth reading. That's where they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroths. And the anger was hot against the Israelites, so he delivered them into the hands of the plunderers. And he entered into the hands of the enemies all around them. I think I wrote down the wrong verse there, but it does make the point that they no longer were solely worshiping God. Their faith was relying on substitutes, however worthwhile or not worthwhile those substitutes were, which is, I think, is a very applicable point for us today, which we'll come back to. But eventually these drifts led to complete, what God called complete abandonment of him and his way. Yeah, Mike.
If you can't tell, I like to always bring things back to our current age.
Those of us that grew up in the 50s, 60s, particularly, have seen a drift in mainstream religion, not just the church. I've got some Baptist friends that can't believe where their faith group has gone. Catholics cannot believe where they have gone to. So this is all the type of drift that you're talking about. It doesn't happen overnight. But looking back, comparing this to how many years is that, Brian? Probably 40 or 50 years ago, there's a big difference in mainstream religion that even the people in those places are not happy with where it's drifted to. So that's the same type of thing you're talking about here. It doesn't happen overnight, but it's accumulation of time.
And towards the end, we will get to maybe what the New Testament advocates as the remedy for us in those situations. But I think you're spot on there. So they didn't really just like throw their hands up at God overnight, but they did stray. They did abandon God. They served the Baals. They worshiped idols. They did everything God had asked them not to, whether it was teaching their kids or stoning people or, you know, bowing down to idols. Surely they knew the story of Aaron and the golden calf. You know, they had a lot here. And this is the common cycle of sin, right? And you can see, if you can read that, man, I tried to do better this time, guys. 2:11 and 13, they served the Baals. 2:14 and 15, God put the people into slavery, and when they went to battle, they would lose. They had this punishment. Later, it says in verse 18 that the Lord was moved to pity by their cries. Verse 16, the Lord would raise up these judges. In this particular case, it's not a specific judge. He's just saying the pattern, right? The pattern is the Lord would raise up judges, and as soon as those people died, as soon as the judges were gone or wafered on their own, the people whored after the idols and returned back to their sin. This whole thing doesn't even highlight who. There's not even a name in here of a judge. Who is the Redeemer in this story? Over and over and over and over, it's God, right? This story is not about the muscles of Samson or the courage of a woman judge or, any of these particular heroics. We identify with those stories. It's what makes them interesting and I think worthwhile for us to study. But the hero here, the Redeemer here, is always God. And I think this is a bit of a paraphrase of that verse 19. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and soon turned aside from the way which their fathers had walked. So, yeah, Michael.
This is going to seem out of place, but early on you had us thinking about Moses and Joshua and all the things that had happened, and I just started thumbing through the Bible, you know, just trying to remember more about, and I was reminded that Joshua was Moses' assistant from his youth. Like he was like, you know, the apprentice almost, you know, he was with Moses, you know, there was that mentor kind of relationship there, Moses being the leader. And then, you know, the Lord chose Joshua, you know, the mantle was passed, so to speak, to Joshua. But you, with Joshua, you don't read about there being somebody else after him, you know, that he, and I don't know, it seems like there's kind of a hole. Joshua dies and nobody's mentioned. There's just God, and there's people who strayed, who they died, and the next generation didn't know him. And I guess all that to say is how valuable it is for younger to follow the older, the people who've been around, who have strong faith, who know. It just made me think of that, and I wanted to share.
First John over and over, you know, the older men teach the older women, teach the younger women being subject to the older women, like over and over to your point. There is a reason for those relationships, and that is so you can maybe so you can experience God, to Ian's point, through people who have been there. And there's It's funny to think about the fact that Joshua was probably in Egypt. He probably encountered the entire plague and Passover scene. I don't think we read about that, but if he was old enough to be there at Sinai and be useful to Moses and be a spy, he had to be old enough to experience all those things.
If I may, I think that there in this story, there's an aspect of the community that got lost as a part of this process. When you see these elders kind of slowly fade away, you're talking about people who are leaders in the community, who would rally people together, give people purpose and direction, pass on these stories, relive these stories with their individual groups that they were responsible for. And it's, you know, if you've ever had like a, for me, I had an uncle in my family who was like the glue that held the family together. He always organized the family events. He always, you know, whipped me into shape when I was a teenager and I didn't want to do the right thing. He was always there to keep people in line and make sure people were where they needed to be at the right time. But once he passed, you know, we're looking back, the family just eroded after that, because there was no leader, nobody to take that responsibility. And I just think that's such a big piece of this story to me, is people as a part of a community being willing to step up into roles of leadership and just take it upon themselves with the responsibility to keep that community together, to tell those stories that are powerful and impactful that you can pass on to your children and your children's children that show the truth of God's power.
Yep. I appreciate the thought there. So over and over, the people went into crisis, their own doing, and over, God redeemed them. And that's the pattern that we're going to talk about all quarter long here. But it does come to the end here, and you know, in the first six verses of chapter 3, we learn about the real crisis, which is God is condemning them. And I don't know, maybe this is a reiterance of what happened, you know, with the angel coming down at the beginning of chapter 2 and saying, you're not going to ever drive out the people. The real crisis here is, because you failed me, I can't fulfill my promise to you. You're going to have to live with this. You're going to have to figure out how to deal with this. You're going to have to figure out how to be successful and be faithful and to love me despite the fact that you live among people who want you to do things differently than the covenant we have together here. And, you know, this crisis is... Yeah, I mean, it's not like, okay, I'm just letting you to rot. He says to them, I am going to do what to you? I'm going to test you. And that's not typically, you know, we think often of scriptures like, you know, that God will not put you more than you can bear or tempt you in any way. But clearly God is testing them here. We see that several times in 2:22, as well as in the first six verses of chapter 3. And why does he say that he's going to do that here?
That he's testing them to prove or to purify, not necessarily to be like, ha, got you, you sinned. It's to show improvement and to come back to him. And they can choose to melt and, you know, not become pure. But there is an actual difference. I mean, I've had people ask me that, you know, growing up a preacher kid all the time, well, what about this or that? And it's like, well, it's a test. It's not a temptation. It's not, he's wanting you to sin, trip you up.
He's not pulling you into sin. Yeah. He's testing to see if you will. And it's an important distinction. Yeah, Xavier.
I think testing, well, okay, so first, thank you, John. You've done a very good job. And I know that because I've asked some stupid questions and you've been very gracious towards me. And so, but besides that, testing, I think, is not God putting you to the test, but God, when you use the word abandonment, it makes me think of 1 Corinthians where the unbelieving spouse abandons the believing spouse, and you're supposed to just let them go. And that's kind of what God is doing here with the Israelites, is like, it's not that he's wanting them to go away or he's wanting to test them, but it's he's allowing them to leave his presence. And that's a test in and of itself, where, okay, see how you do by yourself without me. It won't go well. I'm going to test you, or rather allow you to walk away from me. And but he wants you to come back, and he's hoping you'll come back, and he'll be there if you do want to come back. And I don't think it's, he's creating the test. He's allowing you to walk away and be tested.
I mean, these three ideas are all pulled out of the text here. It reveals the heart. Do you have faith in me? Are you committed and convicted with my way and my will? It exposes obedience, right? The test will show, are you being obedient? And to some extent, these kids have not seen the war. They have not been through the trials that made them faithful. So I will give you the exposure. I will give you the experience. I will give you what's necessary to make you faithful. And over did they pass the test? Judges 3:6 says, no, they took daughters of the Canaanites and served their gods. Yeah, Brian.
Deuteronomy 8:2, he says, I will test you to see whether you obey my commandments. And we see that confirmed as well in 1 Peter, talking about being tried by fire as gold is purified, and that our testing is proof of our faith, which brings God's approval. And by the way, the word temptation itself means to test, which also means to prove. If you test something, you're proving it. So, and we're perfected by the things we suffer, because when you get tested, you get stronger. It hurts like crazy, but you do get stronger.
Yeah, don't pray for trials if you don't pray to be stronger if you don't want trials, right? That's how you get there. So, we're using the last 4 minutes here. So, I think this is probably the heavier, weightier part of the conversation. So we'll push it to the very end and cover it as fast as we can. But Hebrews 2:1, I've said the word drift a lot here. I think that's what the example we see here in Judges 2 and probably throughout the book of Judges establishes is this idea of drift. Hebrews 2:1, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. So this idea, knowledge, Deuteronomy 6, knowledge was key. Living it was key to sharing it with your children. If as a child, if I'm not paying attention, if I'm not engaged with, if I'm not experiencing that information that's coming down, if I'm not paying attention, I will drift away from it. And how frequent is that? All the time, right? Pay attention all the time. Any little deviation over enough time is a huge deviation. What else did they do? They had these people living amongst them, and so therefore they were conforming to the ways, the idol worship that was amongst them. Romans 12:2. How else do we prevent this drift? Do not be conformed to the ways of this world, but transformed, right? So we don't want to be exposed and experiencing the life the world is living with them. We want to be transformed and intentionally different from them, right? Galatians 5, two different verbs here, right? Stand firm and walk by, right? And I think there's probably different ways to interpret walk by, but can you imagine if you're trying to go the straight and narrow and you're walking by the Spirit the whole way, are you going to drift? Are you going to get out of sorts? Might not be the most literal interpretation of that verse, but I do think there's something to that, right? Stand firm. Don't go back to the ways that made your fathers be oppressed and enslaved to the Canaanites around you, right? Stand firm and don't return to slavery. Obviously, it's not slavery like they were used to, but the slavery of sin, right? And then I thought of Hebrews 6, just to have the sure and steadfast anchor of the soul. Let's read that, maybe as a closing thought here. These paraphrases are good, but for a slide, but does anybody want to read that for us? Hebrews 6:19.
I got it, John. Hebrews 6:19. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek.
Thank you. So having this hope that we are anchored in, right? If we don't know where we're going, if we don't know what we're doing, how can we have that hope? And I think there was probably 4 or 5 more minutes to dwell on Mike's point that whether it's as an individual or collective body, that drift is certainly easy to accomplish, and it doesn't feel that hard in the beginning. But there are ways that we can protect ourselves from drifting those. So thanks for the attention this week, and we will look to HE for the next lesson. Judges 3:7 through 31 here, so through the end of the chapter 3 for next week.